All right, my name is Kenneth Thompson. I'd like to be identified as the Executive Director of Musical Arts Center of San Antonio, but I'm also speaking today as Rhiannon's teacher.
Hello, my name is Rhiannon Bishop, and I would like to be identified as just Rhiannon.
Right on. Okay. When you were 6 years old and you started taking piano lessons for the first time, I mean, what was it about the sound of the piano? What was it that made you just want to learn music?
I think it was because my mom always played the classical radio station around me ever since I was born, and also she would put it on different broadcasts, like on television, like on BBC and stuff. They would have featured pianists, and even, you know, the pianist on Sesame Street when I was little, I was just always thoroughly engrossed with it. And when I was 6 years old, I just told my mom, "Hey, Mom, I would really like to learn the piano." So,
did you all have a piano in your home at the time?
No, sir, we didn't. My mom went out to Sam's Club and she purchased a starter keyboard. Mm-hmm. So that's what I started out on for about a couple years.
Yeah. So. And was it, because I know, like, it was a big concern when my kids started taking music lessons too. They said, "Well, we want to make sure you get a keyboard with weighted keys on it." Did you have one? Was it one of those, or was it like those, you know, the keys where they're, you know, just like a keyboard type thing? I'm just curious.
No, sir. They actually did have weighted keys.
Oh, cool. So. Cool. All right. So, and you know, at that age, you know, that early age, how were you practicing?
I would practice a good 1 to 2 hours per week.
I think that's understandable for
seven years old.
I mean, that's really
short
good.
Attention span.
yeah. No. I mean, it's tough. I was just having a conversation yesterday. My kids are 8 and 10, and so I'm like, it's a struggle, you know. I mean, when parents work and, you know, you get home and you've got homework and you've got other responsibilities and you're a kid and you want to do things too.
Yes.
I mean, but what did you see though as you were playing? I mean, what made you want to keep with it even at that early age too?
Well, I just thought, you know, the piano was just really cool. You know, I just wanted to be like the people featured on TV and stuff. And of course, back then I was so little, I didn't really understand like the aspects of sound and stuff. So I thought it was cool that when you press the button, sound comes out. So I wasn't really into listening closely back then. But I don't know. I was just really interested in it. So.
And did you, I mean, were there, at that time, were there particular pieces of music that you heard that you remember hearing maybe on the radio or on CDs that you thought, oh, that's really beautiful? I mean, you know, maybe I could do something like that someday.
Yes, sir.
What was one of those things, the early pieces?
Well, I really hate to say it, but this is such a generic answer, but, you know, the classic Furleys. Furry leaves. What, you know how some kids mispronounce
you called it furry
that.
Leaves.
Furry leaves.
Oh, that's cool. I mean, it's a beautiful melody, of course. I mean, it's there's something almost, I mean, childlike in it, I think, that piece of music in particular that kids latch on to. I mean, it's very song-like.
Yes,
yeah.
Sir.
Yeah. So at one point, I mean, you know, you're going along, and then I guess, and now you're 17, yeah?
Yes, sir.
So for, then at age 11 is when you started working with Ken Thompson at Musical Arts Center. I mean, what was the impetus to kind of, like, start, you know, taking lessons with Mr. Thompson here?
Well, actually, I was performing at a Judge's Choice recital, which is a local recital here in San Antonio, which is kind of like the grand prize for doing this little competition called Achievement Auditions. And I was about 9 or 10 years old, and after I played this piece. I actually remember what the piece was. It was Dennis Alexander's Trees Whisper. It was in A minor. I even remember that. But anyway, after the recital, I just see this very tall man with a very booming voice walk up to my mom and I, and he just was really impressed with how musical I was able to be at such a young age, and then he offered to start coaching me. So we did coachings once a month for about a year, and then he took me on as his full-time student.
Ken, this sounds an awful lot like I can imagine, like, you know, when you're watching the pitcher on the mound out there, mm-hmm. and you go, boy, you know, that kid's got talent.
That's exactly what it was. I'm actually amazed you remember that so well, because I was going to say the same story. I was sitting there, you know, enjoying the concert, enjoying all the kids playing. But when Rhiannon was performing, there was something that really reached through my ears and into my heart. I mean, she really had something that got from her heart into the hearts of the audience. And, you know, I was like, I need to talk to that girl. So I was very grateful. She was studying with a really excellent teacher in town, Jenny Godsey, at that time. And I knew she was well trained. And so that's when we're also good friends. And I said, you know, would you mind if I coached her? And we made an arrangement. And then eventually we made the transition to where she would study with me full time. And she was actually the last student I took for about 5 years, actually. And, because I was downsizing my studio to focus more on my duties as executive director of Musical Arts Center. But it's been a great journey with her to see her grow up and do all this wonderful music now.
So explain also what the difference is between when you say, I want to coach her mm-hmm. while she's still taking lessons with another teacher mm-hmm. Versus I'm taking
transition.
Full-time study.
Sure. Yeah. I think part of it is that when you're working with a coach, especially if the coach works really well with the primary teacher, we can often work in concert with each other, and I can ask the primary teacher, what is it that the student needs? Do they need more pushing? Do they need more support? That's the way it works ideally. So it might be that I'm exposing them to different types of technical approaches or musical approaches, or growing them in a certain direction that teacher may not not have that particular skill set. And that's not to say that I think a really great beginner teacher and a really great advanced teacher are equals. It's just that they're different sets of skills. So the coaching helps to augment what the private teacher or the primary teacher has been doing. Now, when I transitioned her over, that's when I really started her on a big technique transformation, which took many hard lessons to get through, and she can attest to that. As a matter of fact, there was one lesson that someone came and observed me teaching her when she was 11 years old that was almost 2 hours of pure technique, and this person left, and I'm sure they thought, you know, he's torturing this girl, you know, for 2 hours why is she coming back, you know, every week? But that's part of what's different, is when you take them on as a full-time student, it's going to be a lot more, much more in depth, in terms of the technical training and then the mental training for memorizing well and all that. So it's, that would be the primary difference, I would say.
So what did he bring out? What was he working on? Was it hand positioning, things that would keep you strong over the years? Some of those technical things that he was bringing out and instilling in you at that time?
Well, at that time he was, teaching me this specific technique called the Taubman technique. And like Mr. Thompson said, it took me a very long time to learn it. But I'm very glad that I did learn it, because having that foundation, I'm able to solve technical problems very quickly, and also solve other people's technical problems, which is a really good thing to have, you know. So
one of the things that's just to go a little bit further with that, that's in a way, it's hard to learn really high level technique when you go to college, because you're always focused on getting through your juries or getting through that next semester. And it takes a good couple, 3 years, even if you're going fast, to really transform your technique. So the best time to learn it is in pre-college. So there's kind of a group of pre-college teachers, particularly in Texas, but of course elsewhere too, that really focus on getting their students to a high level of technical achievement in pre-college. So that then when they go to college, they can sort of do anything that their teacher would like them to do. They don't have to, they may change their technique, of course, and adapt it, but by training them at a really high level early, they're able to be very adaptable. And then the other plus is they learn how to teach it as well. So when she's out in the workforce at some point, and no matter how good you are at performing, you're going to be teaching as well at some time. I think she's going to be really well equipped for that. So it's worth the torturous investment, but it is hard. I mean, it's not for everyone. You know, it's a quite difficult path. However, it's a really rewarding path. If you really want to unlock your complete musical imagination, you need to have a way to produce it. And so that's I just wanted to add that there. So
you're talking about how you like to solve people's technical problems and technique problems. And you, by that same token as well, Ken, I guess, what is it then that you find that is in yourself that makes you able to do that? You've learned it. You've learned it, but what makes you able to communicate that to others? Because you feel like you have a skill set for that, I guess. How do you communicate with other players?
Well, I usually don't just tell other players how to, you know, solve their problems, because that would seem a little rude, but I only do that, you know, when they ask me, do you have any suggestions for this? And I'll usually give them the correct technical approach to it, and it usually, a good 95% of the time, it usually fixes it right away for mm-hmm. them. And I have a couple of students who I teach, and they're kind of beginner intermediate, but I already started them out on this technique and they seem to be catching on, and they're already able to apply some of the strategies into their music, which is really good. So
one thing I want to add real quick, because you know, once we get deep into the weeds of talking about technique, sometimes what will be lost is the fact of what is it really for. And of course what it really is for is so that they can soar and do anything they want, anything that our imagination can conjure up. And I sometimes liken it to, like, if you're with an airplane, like, you really want the airplane to work, you know, but when you're flying the airplane, you don't want to be thinking about whether the wings are going to work or whether the engine's going to work. And yet you need all that stuff to work. Like, every part needs to work. And so that's why we focus on the technique a lot, but we also try to not get overly obsessed with it. It's just that it's usually that's the big difference I've seen, is whether or not a person is willing to go through what's necessary to really get past that barrier, that technical barrier, where they can really do just about anything they want. But again, the primary thing is so that they can really soar and do their best musically. And it's all tied into the ear and as well as the body. So you work on the body a lot, the physicality, but always tied into the ear and then the expression. And I think that that's just particularly important to mention. And part of the reason this is important too is because on this program is Gaspard La Nuit, which has Scarbo as the last movement, which is was not just written for this reason, but Ravel decided, hey, I'm going to try to make this the most difficult piano piece ever. And Rhiannon's doing a fabulous job with that. And so this particular program has a highly technical work on it. But I also want to say that it's balanced by a lot of the program is also quite spacious and quote unquote non-technical, even though playing a gorgeous pianissimo slowly is also quite quote unquote technical, right? So anyway.
Yeah, so let's we'll talk about the program in just a second here, but like we don't want to get lost, like you said, of focusing entirely on technique and not talking about the musicality and the mm-hmm. music itself, because, you know, like you gave the airplane analogy, I was also thinking of jazz musicians who learn scales and have have the ability to do whatever their imagination, you know, can take them to. And so, you know, musically and the pieces again that you've wanted to aim towards in your playing, what have your goals been? I mean, like, as far as like the music that you love, the music that you want to hear coming out of your own fingers, What did you, what do you like, I guess?
So, you're basically asking like my favorite,
Yeah. I mean, like what are, I mean, you, cause we have a very technical piece that's on this program, like he was saying, but I mean, obviously there's musicality to it as well. So,
yes,
you know, what are the, what were your goals? What are the pieces that you've been aiming towards, both and under both skills, under musicality as well as technicality, that you really admire?
Well, to be completely honest with you, all of Gaspard was actually on my dream list. I started like a dream list of pieces that I want to play, and I remember I was listening in on the San Antonio International Piano Competition about 3 or 4 years ago, and several people who were competing had played one or two movements from the set, and that was actually the first time I had heard it, so I just instantly fell in love with it and automatically put it on my dream list. And it's sort of surreal that I'm actually playing it now because I've just loved it so much. But
cool.
Yeah.
So and how do y'all choose the? Did you choose the entire program together, I guess, kind of working in concert with one another?
I would say so, yeah. And actually, it's interesting you mentioned the dream list, because that's another thing that I think is really critical. You don't get through that difficult technical work and all that stuff without a dream list. You have to have dreams. Dreams are really, really important. So we do work a lot on maintaining a dream list, particularly when we were starting. We did a lot with your dream list, and then it just got so full that I figured she'd be fine for now,
for the next decade.
Yeah, she's good now. She's going to be plenty busy. But I think that's really important to have a dream list. You know, without a dream, we can't set goals, and a goal with a dream attached to it is so much more powerful. That makes you willing to do all that work. You know, if you have that that dream and it inspires you, it's very important. So. So certainly, anybody who's ready for something on their dream list, then absolutely, let's get that on there. And then what was interesting was she brought the Mompou set to me. I wasn't familiar with that particular set, just through her own exploration. And it's this wonderful group of pieces that are just very spatial, impressionist in a different way than the Ravel is. And again, such a contrast in terms of just, I would say in those, your music, you have to be completely musically oriented in those. And again, that was what she brought. And then of course I'm getting ready for auditions. So we had to do a Mozart sonata and a Bach prelude and fugue. And we just picked some, you know, really great ones, I think, of those choices as well. But I definitely like it if the students are out hunting, you know, and she did a good job with hunting and finding this Mompou for sure.
Yeah, talk about the Mompou, because there's an interesting thing about this collection of pieces is, you know, it's kind of like very descriptive of the Spanish landscape, and he wrote it over the course of like 18 years, lots of different, so you've got a lot of different styles in the mm-hmm. music as well.
Yes, sir. So are you wanting me to talk about the music in detail, or how I came across the music, or
anything you like, you know?
Well, how I discovered the music was about a year ago. I listened to a pianist give a recital in San Antonio, and he had programmed that in the middle of it, and it was a really nice diversion from his other virtuosic pieces. But I just instantly fell in love with the simplicity of it. So I had ordered the music as soon as I got home that day, and I just started learning it as soon as it came in. And then I actually had everything learned, and I don't even think I told Mr. Thompson that I was learning it. I just brought it into the lesson and performed it. But to talk a little bit about the music, it consists of three movements. The first movement is called The Fountain and the Bell, and it's actually a very descriptive title because it starts out with the bell tolling, and then it quickly changes into the fountain, and then as the fountain is going, you can hear the bell coming in, and then it ends in just the bell, which is really interesting. But the second movement is called The Lake, and that one is also really descriptive because it actually sounds like a lake. It sounds like water flowing, and in the development part of the piece, you can hear splashes of water and then a waterfall and things like that. And then the third movement is a little bit strange. It's called the Chariots of Galicia. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but it's a city in northwestern Spain. And out
is this
of
the one
the
he
whole...
wrote last? Is it,
mm-hmm.
the,
yes, yeah, sir. Yeah. This was the one he wrote in 1960.
Yeah, so it's all, there's all this kind of like strange tonality in it, too.
Yes, right? Sir. It has a really interesting, somewhat angular melodic line, and it's actually quite difficult to make the connections between the notes and the melody because you'll have, you know, a minor second, and then that goes into, like, a diminished octave and stuff like that. So it's kind of difficult to make sense of that and keep the flow going.
How do you feel it all hangs together for you as a performer then, as you're navigating these three different moods?
I don't quite understand.
Yeah, like, I mean, like, so, you know, he's got these different styles of, you know, writing and playing that he's done mm-hmm. throughout his career, and yet it's lumped as a package, you know, of a piece. So for a listener, you know, you're kind of on the outside just listening to the piece, you can kind of recognize his different styles that he's written over the years, and even the fact that it is kind of written over several years, but yet we put it together as one piece of music. Here's these three, you know, things that go together. So I'm wondering from the inside as a performer, you know, how do you, you know, feel it holds together as a whole work with three different parts to it, I guess, so to speak.
Well, it's interesting that you asked that because I just recently found out that it was written over a period of 18 years. And recently as in yesterday. So with that knowledge, I can
like,
definitely
oh, it makes sense.
I can definitely make more sense of how drastic the mood changes are between the movements. I mean I wouldn't say drastic, but they're definitely quite different. And it definitely sounds like they were written over, you know, several years. So
I mean, if I can add something, I mean, it's actually been a great musical challenge, really, of the four different works on the program. I would say that set has been the one that we've played with the most in terms of just trying to find what's going to work, particularly that final movement. And part of what I think has helped is that she's playing them without too much of a stop between. So she's playing them in sort of like one continuous stream, I would say. The markings in the final one are almost contrary to what is pianistic. So it's an example of sometimes I kind of wish we could call him up. I mean, he did live well into the 20th century, but not being alive now is a big problem. We can't call him up. And there's just some markings in there that are really acoustically challenging, to say the least, that we had to figure out what to do. And, you know, the other works on the program are hands down famous masterpiece type works. And so bringing in a more obscure work is actually kind of wonderful to have. Otherwise, you just have all these masterpieces and whatever. And there's a certain intimidation sometimes with a masterpiece, like, oh, I'm playing Gaspar Noé, you know, I'm playing this Mozart sonata everybody knows. And, you know, with these, there's a freedom because that's not there. But then on the other side of it, sometimes it asks something very different from the performer because you have to sort of... You have a clean slate in some ways that you don't have with the other works, but then sometimes the material is so open that sometimes it's just hard to hang it together. Now, I think you are making it hang together beautifully now, but it was a challenge. I felt it was a challenge. Did you feel that way also?
Yes, I definitely felt that way. Like he said, there are very The markings are just very strange in it, and it was very difficult to try to make sense of it. And because it's so spacious, you just have to rely only on your musicality and your imagination. So it was definitely something good for me to play, because I have a really virtuosic repertoire. So
the thing that happens a lot of times is that when you play a lot of virtuosic repertoire, sometimes you can, because of the virtuosity itself, it's like entertaining enough, I guess, in some ways, but it doesn't necessarily teach you artistry sometimes. And so by stripping away what one would consider virtuosity and having to purely work with just sound and rhythm, then when you go back to the virtuosic piece, you really, because ideally you want to approach a virtuosic piece as an artist and not even consider the virtuosity. It's just assumed, right? So you don't want to approach a virtuosic, I mean, ideally you want it to be, you know, this purely musical thing, and your technique just serves all that. But when one is in this, a student, and working hard to get so much better with their technical approach, it's easy to sometimes think that that's all you have to do. So I was really proud of you for picking those pieces out. And that's why when you brought them in, I was like, these would be great. We have to use these. So, and they make a really interesting contrast to the Ravel, because the Ravel is also in some ways quite spacious, but Ravel fills in what Monpou removes.
Yes, just to add to that, a quick comment. We thought it would be really interesting to program the Monpou directly before the Ravel, to take impressionism from one extreme to the very next extreme.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. And of course, you got a staple on the program. You have Bach. Are you a fan of Bach?
Well, I really enjoy listening to Bach. I'm starting to learn to enjoy performing Bach, but it is very easy to get lost, you know, because the harmonic rhythm is so quick in it.
Mm-hmm. So, get lost. I mean, there's two ways you can get lost. I guess you can get lost, just kind of like get lost in the music, but then you're actually talking about getting lost.
Getting lost, literally getting lost. If let's say your right hand is 1/16th note off from your left hand, it'll work really well for a good 3 or 4 measures, and then you finally realize, my hands are off, and it just kind of throws things for a loop.
I think part of what's so challenging is that you're dealing with a more, you know, organically written piece where you've got several lines that are intersecting and weaving around each other, and especially in the fugue. Fugues, everybody, well, not everybody, I'm sure, but most of the people that I know who play fugues generally are, fear getting lost in a fugue, because unless you can improvise your way out of a fugue, which is not an art that many people can still have success in, it can be quite scary. But it's wonderful music. It's just that it's a different kind of a challenge, and brings up different kinds of concerns. Yeah. One thing I want to say though about this prelude, real quick, that I think is true of the other. When we've done Bach before, there's a lot of jazz in Bach, I think. If there's a lot of offbeats, and there's a lot of fun that can be had. I think the wigs do nothing to make one think that Bach was a fun guy, but I'm pretty sure he was, you know, just by listening to his music and playing so much of it. But I think if one can approach it with a freshness and sense the rhythmic vitality that's in there with even 21st century ears, you know, then that one can really make it come alive. And I think you're doing that quite well.
Yeah, I went to the Simona Dinnerstein concert back in January, I guess it mm-hmm. was, and she played some Bach on the program. And, like, there were audience members who were kind of like, they're like grooving along
yes,
with
exactly.
it, you know, because some
yeah.
Bach pieces can really do that. You
they
know?
Can. Yeah. They can. And you know, in a way, I mean, I'm probably going to get thrown out of every music teacher association, but one of the things is that we sometimes teach Bach, or the earliest Bach we'll teach people is sometimes the stuff he wrote in a more academic kind of way and not the most fun. If we taught the most fun, easier Bach stuff first, I think a lot more people would be like, Bach, awesome. Bach rocks. You know, I think we'd get more of that. But we teach the stuff that's more, you know, interesting for, I mean, phenomenal complexity and economy of, you know, what he's done to write. But I think it's sometimes if you're nine, that doesn't really, you know, roll, you know, make you excited. And I think if we taught, there's some wonderful short pieces that are much more fun than what we usually teach people at that age. I think it would be, you get a lot more Bach fans out there, you know? So,
well, what does this recital mean to you as far as, you know, your own training, your own, playing and performing, you know, is it a milestone for you? I mean, what, how is this in terms of, you know, your development, you feel, this particular grouping of pieces in this recital?
Well, I feel that this recital is very important because a lot of what I will be auditioning with for college is on this program for this recital. Like, I'm using the Bach, I'm using the Mozart, I'm using the Ravel for college auditions. So I feel that it's really good for me to perform them in a professional setting and so early on before my college auditions. So when I finally do the college auditions, I'll feel really comfortable and stuff.
Where do you hope to go to school? Where are you looking at?
I'm looking at a few colleges. I'll be doing my pre-screening this fall for UT Austin, Eastman School of Music, the University of Washington, Penn State, University of Houston, and I think that's it.
Yeah, so. Cool. And, you know, Ken mentioned that you'll always be teaching, but what's, you know, performers always teach, you know, but like, what do you hope to do in the future? You know, post-college, you know, looking ahead, I don't know, 10 years from now, what do you want to be doing?
Well, 10 years from now, I'm hoping to have my doctorate in music, and I would really enjoy teaching at a college level, like in a university or conservatory setting, with also teaching pre-collegiate students on the side. And definitely continue to perform and enter various competitions and stuff and keep that going.
Cool. Well, Ken noted two things about you that I wanted to ask that are completely non-musical or and one is that, and it's so funny, have you seen Pee-wee's Big Adventure?
That is actually in my top 10 favorite movies.
So I took one of those mattresses, the do not remove mattresses, and I cut one of them off.
Yes.
Why do you collect do not remove tags?
To be completely honest with you, sir, I have no idea. It's just an urge that comes over me, and I just cannot control it.
You're a rebel.
Well, I think what it was
lawbreaker.
When I was younger, about 10 years old, I had all of these cute little decorative pillows that I would put on my bed when it was made, and they would have these gigantic do not remove tags, and the do not remove tag was just, you know, a fourth of the size of the pillow, and I just thought it was ridiculous, so I just cut it off, and I just kept it, and my collection has grown over the years.
Maybe if you don't dispose of them, then there's no, you know, the evidence you can control.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think so that was my mindset back then, and I just haven't stopped.
Well, one day it'll be found, and you know.
right. They'll come after you.
Is there a statute of limitations for removing?
I think there is. I think I was reading about that just recently. We'll have to verify that. But I think that is a rebellious thing. I think many of us have had that rebel urge to remove that tag. And they did actually start to change it, you know, and say, except by the person who bought it, you know, but which takes a little bit of the fun out of it, I suppose. But I'm sure you have samples of all of those.
I do. Yeah. I do.
And you also like to talk in different accents. Is that right?
Yes.
Like what?
I've been told that I do a pretty good Russian accent.
Like?
Well, this is my Russian accent. I have been told that I do a pretty good job of doing this, you know. I've had lessons and coachings by several Russian teachers, and, you know, I've just become so familiar with the accent, you know.
So. That's good.
Actually, I was wondering if you could do your do not remove tag talk in a Russian accent would be one interesting thing, or if you could say what are some of the things you've heard in lessons, you know, from Russian teachers.
There's this one Russian teacher at a camp I was attending last year, and she was giving a lecture, and okay, I'll just go ahead and say some of the things she was saying. So, you get an offer to play Rachmaninoff Third Concerto in 2 weeks. You have no idea what the first note is. You go out and buy the music. You learn it. You do not turn opportunity down. You say yes. You do not say no. So what if you don't know Rachmaninoff Third Concerto? Big deal. You will learn it. You will not eat. You will not sleep. All you will do is practice, practice, practice. You might get 1 hour of sleep per night, but you will learn it. You will not turn down opportunity. But everything was a big deal, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Everything. And then she went on, in Mother Russia, when I was a child, we learned all of our Mozart sonatas by candlelight. They shut off electricity at 6 p.m. We learn Mozart sonatas, our Bach prelude and fugues. We learn all of that. We know all of Chopin etudes by the time we are 10 years old because we did not sleep. We practiced.
Yes, this sounds like Russia.
Then after you practice, child goes to factory.
Oh, God. Oh, man. All right. Well, thanks, Rhiannon and Ken. So much.